The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello listeners, and welcome to this week's episode of The Conspiracy Vault. This week is looking into the tragic events that unfolded on September 11, 2001 in the United States of America, New York City. Close to 3,000 people were killed in what has been labelled by some as the worst terrorist attack in all of history. Al-Qaeda would later claim responsibility for the attacks, with Osama bin Laden claiming to be the mastermind behind it all. But conspiracy theorists have long since rebuked these explanations, claiming that the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon were in fact carefully laid out plans by America's own government. In this episode, I plan to run through the timeline of events surrounding, the leading up to, day of, and impact after the attacks on 9/11. Once we have this information, I will go through the many conspiracies available on the internet and in books and documentaries. But I must warn listeners that this episode comes with a trigger warning and contains real, potentially upsetting content. History.com provided a lot of information for this episode, including a timeline of events. The website also goes on to tell us that the iconic Twin Towers of downtown Manhattan's World Trade Center were a triumph of human imagination and will. Completed in 1973, the towers stood at 110 stories each, accommodating 50,000 workers and 200,000 daily visitors in 10 million square feet of space. They were the hub of the bustling financial district, a top tourist attraction and a symbol of New York City's and America's steadfast devotion to progress and the future. On September 11, 2001, the World Trade Center became the target of a massive terrorist attack that took the lives of nearly 3,000 people. The disaster also radically altered the skyline of New York City, destroying the twin columns of glass and steel that over the years had come to embody the city itself. The 1939 New York World's Fair included an exhibit called the World Trade Center that was dedicated to the concept of world peace through trade. 7 years later, one of the exhibit's organizers, Winthrop W. Aldrich, headed a new state agency with the proposed goal of creating a permanent trade exposition based in New York. Market research indicated that the city would benefit more by modernizing its ports. However, the plan was soon scrapped. Aldrich's nephew, David Rockefeller, didn't forget the idea. The grandson of Standard Oil founder John D. Rockefeller, David decided to revive the World Trade Center concept as the core of a revitalized Lower Manhattan. In May 1959, Rockefeller formed the Downtown Lower Manhattan Association, which planned a $250 million complex near the Fulton Fish Market on the East River, including a single 70-story office tower and several smaller buildings. So now that we know a little bit about the World Trade Center, let's go back and talk through the official story of 9/11 and how it is told today. In January 2000, Khalid al-Midhar and Nawaf al-Hazmi, members of Al-Qaeda, move onto American soil and settle in San Diego. The CIA is apparently aware of the terrorist affiliation, but does not contact the FBI. In mid-2000, the first two Al-Qaeda members are followed by three more, named Muhammad Atta, Marwan al-Shehi, and Ziad Jarrah, who settled in South Florida, soon enrolling into the Huffman Aviation, Florida Flight School. These would make up three of the four pilot hijackers. In October 2000, Operation Mascal took place. According to Wikipedia, the Pentagon Mass Casualty Project, codenamed Pentagon Mascal, was a contingency exercise that was held in the office of the Secretary of Defense conference room between October 24th and October 26, 2000. The exercise required emergency response teams, members of the Defense Protective Services, and US government officials to conduct emergency simulations in preparation for a possible plane crash into the Pentagon. The fourth pilot hijacker arrived in San Diego in December 2000. His name was Hani Hanjour. In total, there would be 19 hijackers involved in the attacks. The remaining would arrive in America in the first half of 2001. It is stated that these attackers come from four countries, 15 from Saudi Arabia, 2 from the United Arab Emirates, 1 from Lebanon, and 1 from Egypt. August 11, 2001, President Bush is enjoying time in Crawford, Texas. An article from abcnews.com from January 6, 2006 says, "For the next 30 days, it will be home on the ranch for President Bush." With his administration only 6 months old, Bush is set to shed the confines of the White House and head to his sprawling ranch in Crawford, Texas, to begin a month-long outside the Beltway retreat. "I'm headed home to the heartland to listen to the American people and to talk about the values that unite and sustain our country," Bush said in a Rose Garden speech this afternoon. A little fishing, a little policy. Around this time, a memo is sent from the CIA about a potential Al-Qaeda attack, and this information is sent to government officials. The memo is not acted on. An article on politico.eu from 2015 says Bin Laden determined to strike in the US. The CIA's famous presidential daily brief presented to George Washington on August 6, 2001 has always been Exhibit A in the case that his administration shrugged off warnings of an Al-Qaeda attack. But months earlier, starting in the spring of 2001, the CIA repeatedly and urgently began to warn the White House that an attack was coming. On August 13, Mohammed Atta and two other Al-Qaeda members meet in Las Vegas and stayed at the Econo Lodge, reportedly engaging in activities in the so-called Sin City that included drinking, drugs and hiring prostitutes, although this has not been substantiated. An article on sfgate.com has a segment that reads, "The self-styled warriors for Allah, who believed their hijackings would earn them eager virgins in heaven, engaged in some decidedly un-Islamic sampling of prohibited pleasures in America's reputed capital of moral corrosion." At this time, the FBI are also investigating a man named Zacharias Massawi about his flight school attendance in Minnesota. An article on abcnews.com reads, "In an email to a Minnesota flight school, terror suspect Zacharias Massawi wrote that my goal, my dream, would be to pilot one of these Big Bird," a newspaper reported today. Massawi, who investigators believe was meant to be the 20th hijacker on September 11th, wrote on May 23rd to the Pan Am International Flight Academy in suburban Minneapolis seeking flight lessons. A copy of the email was obtained by the New York Times. It says, "I need to know if you can help to achieve my goal, my dream," he writes in broken English. Massawi acknowledges that his qualifications for training could be better, but he says he is sure that you could do something. "After all," he writes, "we are in America and everything is possible." Massawi arrived at the flight school in mid-August and soon raised the suspicions of flight school employees. He paid in cash, peppered instructors with questions about protocols for communicating with flight towers, and was determined to learn fast how to fly a large jetliner. The cash, the Middle Eastern accent, the fact that he had very little pilot training and wanted a significant amount of training in ground school and on the simulator, all these things together pointed to the fact that this was a significant concern, Joe Rosengren, director of operations for the company's training center, told The Times. In his initial message, Massawi says he is interested in learning to fly one of the big airliners and goes on to list several models that he is considering. "It will depend on the cost and which is easiest to learn," he writes. "The level I would like to achieve is to be able to take off and land, to handle communication with air traffic controllers, to be able to successfully navigate from A to B, JFK to Heathrow, for example." The school alerted federal authorities to their suspicions, and on August 15th, the FBI arrested Massawi on visa violation charges. Around this time, Harry Summit from the FBI sends a memo to Washington with suspicions about an attack. After he arrested Massawi and interrogated him for a few hours, he sent this memo. Allegedly, the memo was not read, and the permission to search Massawi's computer was denied. An article from bbcnews.com reads, "Harry Summit, who arrested Massawi a month before the 9/11 attacks, warned bosses on the 18th of August 2001 that he thought Massawi was planning a terror attack. But," he told the court, "FBI head office refused his pleas to obtain a search warrant for the detainee's belongings." Prosecutors allege Massawi's lies on the 9/11 plot prevented the FBI acting, the hijackers begin joining gyms, and Kofa Black, former CIA director, begins warning the Bush administration about the possibility of an imminent attack. An article on the DailyMail.com, written by Evan Bleer, says Bush administration ignored CIA warnings in the months before 9/11 that spectacular terrorist attack on the US was imminent and just didn't get that we were going to be struck, former top agency officials reveal. Condoleezza Rice was told in July 2001 Al-Qaeda was planning significant terrorist attacks against the United States in the coming weeks or months. Former CIA counterterrorism chief Kofa Black and ex-agency director George Tenet revealed the warning was largely ignored before 9/11. Tenet and Black planned an initiative against Al-Qaeda called Blue Sky Paper. Said plan was rejected in May 2001 in order to avoid creating a paper trail. The Bush team didn't get the threat, but it was evident that we were going to be struck. The hijackers would take over four planes. Flight 77, Flight 11, Flight 175, and Flight 93. Flight 77 hijackers then check into Motel Valencia in Maryland near the National Security Offices, and flight training continues. Fayez Banihamad, one of the attackers, then has a large money deposit put in his bank of $100,000. It is around this time that FBI become angry at the CIA for not informing them that two well-known Al-Qaeda members are in America and have been for months, Khalid Mihdhar and Nawaf al-Hazmul, and that they'd been there since January. On August 27th, head of Operation Mohammed Atta goes to Washington to meet with Flight 77 team. He then purchases a utility kit to use on Flight 11. All of the hijackers were equipped with box cutters, and that's how they were able to hijack the passengers and the crew. With the $100,000, one-way airplane tickets were purchased, and the four hijacker pilots obtain FAA pilot licenses, graduating from their flight school. On September 6, Abdulaziz Olamori and Satam Al-Sagami, two of the Flight 11 hijackers, check into the Park Inn Hotel in Boston. Flight 93 hijackers then fly in from Florida and check into the Marriott Hotel in Newark Airport in preparation to board their flight to San Francisco on September 11th. Two of the hijackers, Ziad Jarrah and Mohammed Atta, meet up at the Food Factory, a restaurant in Maryland, before Atta flies to Boston to meet with Flight 175 hijacker Marhan Al-Shehi. The five Flight 77 hijackers then supposedly cook and eat a meal. This would be their last meal in the Maryland Motel. On September 9th, the New York Times released an article on the potential of Al-Qaeda attacking the US. This was removed after the attacks, and I wasn't able to find an archived version of it online. On September 10th, 24 hours before the attacks, leader Mohammed Atta is caught on CCTV with another attacker, Omari, in South Portland at a gas station and Pizza Hut. He then takes a 6 a.m. flight to Boston to arrive in time at the airport and carry out his attack. National Security Agency intercepted a suspected Al-Qaeda conversation with messages saying, quote, the match begins tomorrow, and, quote, tomorrow is 0 day. And Ziad Jarrah writes a farewell letter to his girlfriend in Germany. September 11th, 2001. It's a sunny day at the start of fall. New Yorkers, tourists and workers go about their mornings, bustling through the streets like any other day. At 7:51 a.m, American Airlines Flight 11 takes off from Boston Lodge Airport, going to Los Angeles with 92 crew and passengers. Five of these people are the Flight 11 hijackers. 15 minutes later, United Airlines Flight 175 takes off from Boston to LA with 65 on board. And 20 minutes after takeoff, flight attendants radio ground crew about hijacking and plead for them to call the FBI. At 8:20 a.m, Flight 77 with American Airlines takes off from Dulles Airport and is headed to LA with 64 on board. Soon after this, back on Flight 11, Mohammed Atta can be heard on board, supposedly trying to talk to the cockpit, but accidentally transmitting to air traffic control instead. He can be heard telling the passengers to stay quiet and you'll be okay. Beginning to suspect another hijacking, Northeast Air Defences allegedly scrambled two fighter planes to tail Flight 77, and at 8:41 a.m, being 41 minutes delayed, the final flight, United Airlines Flight 93, leaves Newark Airport and is due to travel to San Francisco. There are 40 passengers on board. It would only be another 5 minutes later, around 56 minutes since departing the airport, that Mohammed Atta would steer Flight 11 into floors 93 and 99 of the North Tower in the World Trade Center, instantly killing hundreds of people within the North Tower. The New York Police Department and the Fire Department of New York are dispatched, and President Bush is notified. During this time, he is attending a book reading at the Emma E. Booker Elementary School in Sarasota, Florida. He was in the middle of reading a book called The Pet Goat. At 9:02, after being told to remain in the building, the North Tower of the World Trade Center is called to evacuate. And only 1 minute later, Flight 175 flies much lower into floors 75 and 85 of the South Tower of the World Trade Center. Only 22 minutes later, the entire events would be worldwide news. Passengers on Flight 77 were able to alert family and friends on the ground that their flight had possibly been hijacked. With phone signal on the plane, they were able to communicate these messages until at 9:37 a.m, Flight 77 crashes into the west side of the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., the headquarters for America's Department of Defense. At 09:42 a.m, 5 minutes after the Pentagon crash, for the first time in history, all flights over U.S. airspace are diverted or grounded. The White House, along with other important buildings, are evacuated and firefighters begin making their way up the towers. At 9:59 a.m, the entire South Tower completely collapses and all 94 floors of the building crumple at freefall speed to the ground. Smoke clouds plummet through the streets and debris begins flying everywhere. 200 miles away, Flight 93 passengers overcome the hijackers on the plane, and the plane is crashed into a field in Pennsylvania. All 40 passengers and crew die instantly on impact. By 10:28, the North Tower of the World Trade Center collapses in the same way that the South Tower did, and 7 hours later, even Building 7 of the World Trade Center would collapse despite not being impacted by a plane. The official story is that the building crumpled from fire. As time passed, it would come to light that at least 2,996 people died from the events on this day. 2,756 within the World Trade Center, 125 at the Pentagon, and 40 on Flight 93 that crashed in a field in Pennsylvania. The victims were aged between 2 and 86, and 80% of them were male. Just over half the victims have been positively identified. 4 months after the attacks, just as the fires were finally put out and the smoke had stopped, Osama bin Laden, the leader of the terrorist group Al-Qaeda, spoke out publicly, taking responsibility for the events on this day. This would lead to the US targeting the Taliban in Afghanistan, dispatching troops to invade the Middle East. Al-Qaeda would lose support in the areas they populated and would dominate through fear or move to more isolated areas of the Middle East. And this chain reaction would spark the longest war in history, with thousands and thousands of more lives lost, domestic and foreign. Allegedly in 2001, a secret black ops team instructed by President Obama found bin Laden in a compound in Pakistan. He was shot dead and buried at sea, although these events also remain a source of contention to conspiracy theorists. Thousands in the area at the time that the World Trade Center buildings collapsed have been affected by cancer, and many are still experiencing side effects from the blasts. No matter what theories I place before you next, or however many pop up online, it is indisputable that millions of people had their lives affected on this day, that there was a huge loss of life, from firefighters to people jumping from the tops of the towers, to those who sadly died on impact or were crushed beneath the rubble. This day shook the world, And even now, watching the footage, it truly is heartbreaking. The documentary Zeitgeist lays out some interesting counter-explanations for 9/11 that USA Today reported that 2 years before the 9/11 attacks, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, or NORAD, were conducting exercises using hijacked airliners as weapons, and one target during these training exercises was the World Trade Center. Then in October 2000, Mascal takes place, a simulated plane crash into the Pentagon. This leads people to believe that the government knew about these imminent attacks and perhaps even planned them. But for the Secretary of State to come forward and say that nobody could have predicted that they would use airplanes as missiles doesn't sound completely true. The documentary then shows a news anchor describing how the Federal Aviation Administration received 52 warnings about Al-Qaeda in the 6 months leading up to 9/11 and did not act on these. Then there is the former secret intelligence unit known as Able Danger, intelligence that had apparently identified 2 of 3 terrorist cells within America that would later become responsible for the attacks. One of these cells included attack leader Mohammed Atta, and these terrorists had allegedly been in the country up to a year before the events of 9/11, although a 2006 report would later dismiss this. Zeitgeist goes on to show newspaper headlines that show Egypt, France, Italy and other countries had forewarned US of an Al-Qaeda plot. Then it shows the head of Pakistani intelligence, Mahmoud Ahmed, had requested that Omar Sheikh, a British terrorist with ties to the Taliban, most famous for kidnapping and murder, to wire $100,000 to attack leader Mohammed Atta. And we already know that this money was used to buy plane tickets for the attacks on that very day. No inquiry was ever made into General Ahmed, despite Sheikh admitting he was ordered to do this by Pakistani intelligence under Ahmed's orders. On the morning of 9/11, government officials were having breakfast with Ahmed in Washington. The 9/11 Commission would later go on to say that the financing of the attacks was, quote, of little practical significance. Despite the plane allegedly disintegrating on impact when it hit the Pentagon, there was a hijacker passport found in the rubble, rubble that contained only fragments the size of a hand palm. The passport belonged to Abdulaziz Al-Amari, one of the alleged hijackers, who went on to tell the Daily Telegraph in 2001, quote, I couldn't believe it when the FBI put me on their list. They gave my name and my date of birth. I am not a suicide bomber. I am here. I am alive. I have no idea how to fly a plane. According to Zeitgeist, 7 of the hijackers are alive today, with the government not amending their list or updating the names. Other theorists have come forward to say that there was one plane that was allowed to fly that day, despite every other plane being grounded or diverted, and that was a plane taking Osama bin Laden from America back over to Saudi Arabia. It's also notable that the plane that hit the western side of the Pentagon, which was under construction, and was also supposedly the one part of the building that was missile-proof, theorists have claimed is too much of a coincidence. The official explanation for the vaporizing of everything was that the jet fuel caused everything to disintegrate. Bin Laden worked with operatives from US intelligence, the Pakistani military and the Arab states. The Taliban also worked with the US against the Soviet Union or USSR many years ago. In 2001, the Bush administration and intelligence agencies ordered the FBI to back off investigations involving the Bin Laden family, including 2 of Osama bin Laden's family members, who were living in Virginia, next to the CIA headquarters. Another part of the documentary goes on to say that once bin Laden was labelled as the most wanted man in America, he spent 2 weeks in the American hospital in Dubai and was treated by an American doctor. The video that bin Laden released, claiming responsibility for the attacks, was reportedly mistranslated to say what the government wanted us to hear. In 1996, Osama's older brother, Salim bin Laden, hired a man in Texas by the name of Jim Barth to handle all the investments in the US for the bin Laden family. Jim Barth also happens to be a personal, lifelong friend and former International Guard pilot for George W. Bush. The connection between the Bushes and the Bin Ladens becomes more and more clear when George Herbert Walker Bush made trips to Saudi Arabia in 1998 to 2000 to meet with the Bin Laden family. This was on behalf of a company called the Carlyle Group. On the morning of 9/11, the Carlyle Group was having a conference in Washington, which included Osama bin Laden's older brother, Safiq bin Laden. The plane that flew directly into the Pentagon reportedly executed a 270-degree downward spiral, something a professional pilot would struggle to execute so perfectly. And yet, Han Hanjour was known as a terrible pilot, and he managed to execute this perfectly. Interestingly, the question is raised, how can tempered steel vaporize from this plane crash? And no parts of the plane were found, but bodies from the plane can be found intact, with the hijackers identified and passports found. The plane that crashed into Shanksville, Pennsylvania, also appears to have vaporized. There is a crater, but not plane parts, and small bits of debris can be seen in the footage captured. 8 miles away, there is another debris zone of small fragments that supposedly make up part of the plane. People have asked, why would there be pieces 8 miles away? Then there is the theory that the Twin Tower structures were detonated with explosives at ground level, just as the plane made impact, which caused the buildings to blow up and eventually completely collapse. This conclusion came from the thousands of witnesses that claimed they heard or were in an explosion just before the plane impact. People talked about being in the basement and being thrown up against the ceiling when something underneath them detonated. And also, the skeleton structure of the building was not left standing as it should have been in this type of catastrophe. Many have speculated that top secret documents in any of the three buildings may have needed to be destroyed. Others have speculated that a building like this should never freefall, which is what happened to all three towers. 200,000 tons of steel fell at an average rate of 10 floors per second. There was also supposedly cut core columns to the structure and molten metal found at the scene. Apparently all three buildings had pools of molten metal. And for well over 6 weeks after the collapse, hot spots of over 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit were documented in the debris. This is over 200 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than jet fuel can burn in the most controlled conditions. The cause of this molten metal under all three buildings was not documented in any official reports, nor was the molten metal itself. Despite being reported by firefighters and investigators on the scene, thermite was also supposedly found in the wreckage of the foundations, which is an explosive or incendiary that can cut through steel like a knife through butter. When the three components of thermite interact, they create a huge dust cloud. Those are what the enormous dust clouds on the day supposedly contained and may have been contributing towards the cancer cases that people see today. The rubble examined by professionals was also found to have thermite, but again, was never discussed in any reports. The last point from the Zeitgeist documentary to note is that there was training going on with the Northeast Air Defences, who scrambled their jets to tail Flight 77. However, on that day, they were also running simulations and practicing for attacks just like this. The perimeters of the training that they were using was a terrorist attack on the World Trade Center. So when the calls came in that the hijackers had hijacked planes and were heading for the World Trade Center, the people operating were not sure whether it was training or real life. This also happened with the 7/7 bombings in London. The law enforcement and bomb disposal squads were undergoing in London on that day included the exact parameters that the attacks actually happened on the subways. History.com goes on to give us some other conspiracy theories. Number one, that the Twin Towers were brought down by explosives, not planes. Within just a few hours of the attacks on the Twin Towers, perhaps the most well-known of the theories had already surfaced in an internet chat room. The author of that post likened the collapse of the North and South Towers to an act of controlled demolition due to the way buildings fell so quickly and perfectly in their own footprint. After the dust had settled, theorists raised further evidence in the form of witness testimonies, citing reports of explosions being heard before the towers collapsed and debris visibly shooting out from the lower levels of the buildings. When the official report stated the towers fell due to severe structural damage caused by the planes and resulting fires, conspiracy theorists, or truthers as they are otherwise known, argued the fires did not burn for long enough, 56 minutes in the case of the South Tower, to cause the catastrophic collapses. Point 2. A missile hit the Pentagon, not American Airlines Flight 77. Early video footage and photos taken from the scene did not seem to show much evidence of plane wreckage. Theorists maintain this evidence was that the Pentagon was not struck by Flight 77, but by a missile or unmanned drone instead. They also argued that the structural damage to the building was too minor to have been made by a commercial airliner, and questioned why the plane, piloted by an amateur, was even allowed to crash into the headquarters of the United States Department of Defense. Point 3. United Airlines Flight 93 was shot down. According to official reports, the passengers on board Flight 93 attempted to take back the plane from the hijackers, and the subsequent struggle caused the aircraft to crash into an open field in Pennsylvania. As with the Pentagon attack, theorists state that little plane wreckage was actually discovered in the field and crash site itself, and that the site was too small for an airliner of that size, arguing instead that the plane was shot down by the military and so it disintegrated over a larger area. Number 4. The US government knew about the attacks and stood the military down. A common belief amongst truthers is that the North American Aerospace Defense Command, or NORAD, deliberately ordered their fighter jets to stand down and allow the hijacked planes to reach their targets. America seemingly had the most powerful air force in the world, but failed to intercept any of the planes that day, which theorists believe is an indication of a government conspiracy to let the attacks go ahead. Why would they do such a thing? Conspiracy theorists believe that the government wanted to use the attacks to justify an invasion on Iraq and Afghanistan to secure oil interests. And number 5, insider traders knew about the attacks. In the days preceding the attacks, an extraordinary amount of put options, or investments that pay off only when a stock drops in price, were placed on the stocks of two airlines, American Airlines and United Airlines, which happened to be the airlines hijacked during 9/11. As such, some theorists believe that traders had been given advance warning of the attacks and were cashing in on the tragedy. News1.com goes on to offer some different theories. After the September 11th attacks, the Loose Change documentary stated that all of the hijackers were actually alive in other countries, rather presumptuous, since it is possible for two different people to have identical names. But they did raise a good point. How did the passports of the terrorists survive the explosion? In the aftermath of the attacks, passports and identification were found as evidence. Many skeptics question how identification made out of paper survived the same explosion that destroyed buildings. Cell phone calls from the plane were faked. In-flight calls were made from cell phones in both hijacked airplanes. Scientists and skeptics maintain that cell phones could not receive reception from the altitude at which the planes typically fly. Others question a phone call from a son to his mother in which he referred to himself by his own first and last name. Jewish people knew attack was going to happen and took off work on September 11th. Theorists noticed that 4,000 Jewish employees took the day off from work on September 11, 2001. Some of the first people to record the attacks on camera were also Jewish. Many became suspicious and put the religious group on the radar as suspect in the wake of the attack. Number 9. Black boxes found by search crew are kept a secret. During the weeks following the attack, the plane's black boxes were one of the most important items under investigation. They were the only evidence into what happened inside the cockpits of the plane. 3 or 4 black boxes were found and only one was in good enough condition to hear. The tape was not initially released, but shared with families of the victims in 2002. Skeptics believe the tapes were not disclosed in order to support a secret scheme. Number 10. The Bin Laden tapes are fake. Initially, Osama bin Laden denied any involvement with the attacks. Soon afterwards, numerous tapes came out claiming he changed his mind and took full responsibility. Many skeptics believe that bin Laden was targeted because of his stake in the stock market, as well as because of former President George W. Bush's personal business ventures in the Middle East. Number 11. Aluminium planes can't penetrate steel structure of World Trade Center. Commercial airplane frames are constructed with a very light aluminium material in order to make it easier to fly. Theorists maintain there is no possible way an airplane could do as much damage to the Twin Towers as it did. They believe that missiles or explosives were used to ensure the buildings collapsed. 14 years after the attack, we may never know the entire story, but we will always remember the people we lost on that tragic day. These are the main conspiracies around the events of September 11th, 2001. But what are your thoughts? Get in touch at cultvaultpodcast@gmail.com or follow me on Twitter and Instagram @cultvaultpod.